committee on rules. I assume we're on. I didn't give any notice. Okay, good. I know we have a number of folks who've traveled long distances to be here today. We'll try and make sure you all get on as quickly as possible. A couple technical changes to the agenda. Senate Bill 578. We will do a work session. We will not do a work session. We will have a public hearing. Mistake on the agenda. And what was the other issue? Two issues. Okay. All right. With that, we're going to open a public hearing on SJR 34. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the resolution? And
thank you, Madam Chair. SJR 34 expresses legislative support for plans to transfer certain lands acquired by the Burns Paiute Tribe into federal trust.
Thank you. I have Tribal Chair Barbara Sam and Tribal Council Member Awana Johnson. Why don't you both come on up? Good morning and welcome. We don't have all of our committees here, members here, but I suspect they'll get here by the time you all finish. So.
Hey, we have a quorum.
Yeah, I know. We have a quorum. Take it away, Chair.
Bija Awawa. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Barbara Sam, and I'm the tribal chairperson for the Burns Paiute Tribe. And I would like to thank you for this opportunity to present testimony on behalf of the Burns Paiute Tribe on Senate Joint Resolution 34, Fee to Trust Reversion of Logan Valley and Jones Ranch Properties. Our total membership for the Burns Paiute Tribe is 340 members. We are the smallest tribe in the state of Oregon, and our current land base is 770 acres. We are here to encourage your support for Senate Joint Resolution 34. Once the Logan Valley and Jones Ranch properties are in trust, our tribe secures the greatest assurance possible that these lands, which lie within our tribe's Aboriginal territory, will be subject to the trust responsibility of the United States. The benefits that the Burns Paiute Tribe would realize when these lands go into trust are an advance of tribal sovereignty by recognizing the rights of the Burns Paiute tribal government to exist and exercise self-governance over lands sacred to our people. The direction of the land's utilization will be in the hands of the Burns Paiute people once again. An increase in our tribal land base expands the tribe's opportunities to practice our culture and traditions. It also renews a tie to a land our people once walked freely and without hindrance. A positive impact on the tribe's annual funding allocation from the Bureau of Indian Affairs, funding that no doubt will trickle out to surrounding communities through the purchase of goods and services in the severely economically depressed counties. Increased opportunities to coordinate with the state and local governments in areas of interest, which are beneficial to all parties. The tribe in the past has had wonderful relationships with agencies on all levels, federal, state, and local. Again, we urge your support for Senate Joint Resolution 34. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. And as you have received our tribal history and the letter that the tribe has submitted.
Thank you, and there will be become officially part of the record. Councillor Johnson. Do you wish to add anything?
No, I'm just here to present your offer.
But
seriously though, this is very important to the tribe. Our land base might be small. At one point we were the largest reservation, and it is part of your documents that you received this morning. But this is something that that the tribe has. We've heard it from our elders since the treaty was unratified that, we don't have a place. We had to buy our reservation. And so, then it was eventually converted into a trust for us that you know, this is very important to the tribal members. So I'm hoping that you do support this.
And just for the record, Chair Sam, my recollection is the Jones property is the former state representative Denny Jones family's property. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. Yes.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? All right. It's good to get us early in the morning. Thank you both very
Thank
much.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate you traveling the long distance that you did to be here this morning. Okay, with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on SJR 34, unless there's anyone else in the audience wishing to testify on SJR 34. Chair would open a work session on SJR 34. And
Chair, I'd
Senator
like to
Farioli.
Move adoption of SJR 34.
Senator Farioli has moved that the Senate adopt SJR 34. Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing none, so ordered. Senator Farioli, we'd sure appreciate it if you would carry it on the Senate floor.
It'd be an honor. Thank
sure
you.
Appreciate you sharing some of the history for us. Thank you. Who else came from the district? I see. Okay. All right. We're going to open. Oops. We need Charlie. Okay. All right. All right. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1067. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us about the bill? Mr.
Thank
Dugan,
you.
Why don't you come on forward?
Madam Chair, Committee, Senate Bill 1067 expands the crime of telephonic harassment to include sending to or leaving a text message, voicemail, or any other message, knowing that the caller has been forbidden from leaving those types of messages.
Mr. Dugan, welcome. I understand you have a busy schedule, which also includes a presentation from the Senate Judiciary Committee, so take it away.
It does. Thank you very much, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Mike Dugan. I am the District Attorney for Deschutes County. I'm also representing today the Oregon District Attorneys Association in support of Senate Bill 1067. In essence, this bill merely recognizes the advance in technology, particularly with cell phones, and certainly suggests that we should provide the protection for victims of crime that we have provided in the previously in the same statute of 166.090. This is particularly applicable to victims of domestic violence. With the advent of text messaging and the ability to send photographs over the phone, this is a way to protect those victims from additional unwanted contact. I would urge, Madam Chair, the Senate to accept and approve and adopt this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Dugan. The Senate's been presented with a number of domestic violence cases that have really sort of been outside our current statutory prohibitions, and so we appreciate you bringing this issue before us. Any questions for Mr. Dugan?
Yes.
All right. Senator Atkinson, take it away.
How is this
a new crime? And
it's actually not a new crime. It's expansion of a current crime.
Yeah,
okay.
Madam Chair.
How do you enforce this new expansion?
Madam Chair and Senator Atkinson, thank you for that question. Generally speaking, with the advent of the technology available, many of this type of text messaging or photographs are preserved on the recipient's phone. And they would come to us and say, I've been being bombarded by a person we have a protective order against or a restraining order against, and this is the evidence we have.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Feel comfortable?
Yeah.
Great. Thank you, Senator Atkinson. Thank you, Mr. Dugan.
Thank you.
Anybody else wishing to testify on Senate Bill 1067? All right. Seeing no volunteers, we're going to close that public hearing. Okay. All right. Can you call Senator Ringo, please? I'm going to move into a public hearing and work session on SJR 10. I understand there are a couple folks here from Portland on SJR 10. Why don't you come on forward? Um,
Good morning. I understand you're here to testify on SJR 10.
Yes.
As you may recall, we went to Woodburn High School on this measure. It proposes an amendment to the Oregon Constitution to allow voter registration on the same day of the election. So,
yes.
Take it away. I don't have the sign-up sheet, so please introduce yourselves. And
My name is Ruth Bendel, 10980 Southwest Muirwood Drive, Portland, 97225. I was around in Oregon when the Rajneesh took over the city of Antelope, and I also participated in getting the signatures for the constitutional amendment that put in place the 21-day cutoff for voter registration, and people overwhelmingly voted for that cutoff because they wanted, one, that the county clerks would have the time and ability to check to see that people were eligible to vote, and two, because people did not want a recurrence of what occurred in Antelope, where the Rajneesh imported people, whether or not they were eligible to vote in that city, and took over the city. And as far as I'm concerned, and I know that others feel the same, we want proof of eligibility, and we want the county clerks to have the time to do that. A same-day voter registration does not allow for that. We're in a post-9/11 era. Never mind party affiliations. We have adversaries that wish us ill and certainly are aware of the vulnerabilities, the current vulnerabilities of our electoral system. And we are very well aware from other states what's happened when same-day registration occurs and people, there's no time to verify. A trust and don't verify system does not preserve the integrity of any one person's vote. And to devalue, to allow our votes to be devalued by people who are not eligible to vote is derelict. I do urge you to reject Senate Joint Resolution 10. I'll pass it on to Mike Balanese.
Thank you, Ms. Mendel. Mr. Balanese, good morning and welcome.
Morning. And Chair, Madam Brown, and members of the committee, for the three of us, we want to thank you for taking our brief testimony this morning. I know it's wasn't on the agenda as such. What I want to add to Ruth's testimony is expand a little bit. Ruth and I co-authored a House bill which was testified to all over this state in roadshow hearings, and that was HB 2551, where we asked that the secrecy envelopes of ballots not be opened until election morning, 8:30. And that was met by the county clerks with outrage that they would not have time, the proper time, to go open the ballots, etc., and count by 8 o'clock. Start to count, release results at 8 o'clock. Well, this bill, SJR 10, seems to me to be so contrary to the total opposition to our idea, whereas now if the county clerks not only had to verify registrants as late as right up to election day, they not only wouldn't know who the registrant was and be verified, but they would no way be able to open secrecy envelopes that were just turned in at that very point on election day. So it seems to me to be a contradiction as to the opposition to opening secrecy envelopes. This SJR 10 flies at everything to do with integrity of elections. And I'll finish by saying I lived in California in the 80s, and the Antelope situation was so widely publicized that it brought a lot of recognition to us in California on how big a problem this could be to have last-minute registration. So with that, I will close and urge this committee respectfully to not allow Senate Joint Resolution 10 to be forwarded on to the House and subsequently to the voters, where it probably would meet with a resounding defeat. Thank you very much.
Hi. Jim Hodges. I'm a Salem resident, and this just flew in my face. I just was like, I'm coming from it from a common sense standpoint of after everything we've been through as a state, the Rajneeshis, the Portland 7, and coming back to the fact of the people in California who were just arrested. And you guys all might know or heard about this in the news, with planning the terrorism against the nation, basically. And I'm not sure if you all even know that, or I'm sure you do, but I'm hoping you do, with these people that were just arrested here in the last few days. And it's now up to, I think, 7 people. In total that they've arrested. This is just, it needs to come from a common sense standpoint. There shouldn't be any way for anybody to come into our state and take over our state from any type of different nationality, any different type of race, excuse me, any different type of race or any type of politics is, thank you. And again, I just became involved in this yesterday, and I had my little sign now standing out front, and I mean, it's all a common sense standpoint, and I think that everybody that's on this committee looks at it from a common sense standpoint, they would realize that we need to protect our voting registration rights, and that's what it comes down to. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Bendel, Mr. Balanese, or Mr. Hodges, I really appreciate you all coming this morning. My question is for you. There are a number of states, I believe 6 or 7, that do have same-day registration. I think they vary from New Hampshire to Minnesota to Idaho. I am not aware of any voting irregularities particular to those states because of the same-day registration. Do you all, can you give me any specific examples?
The state of Wisconsin, mm-hmm. recently mm-hmm. in the city of Milwaukee, an investigation was done. 1,500 from just the one county were illegal votes, and they have same-day voter registration. 1,500.
Mm-hmm. Chair Brown, members of the committee, the state of Arizona last November, by initiative process, by initiative vote, sanctified proof of citizenship to register to vote. And the rules having been just written, the county clerks in Pima County, Arizona, out of 700 plus voter registrants, rejected 59% because they were not eligible to vote. 59% in Pima County, Arizona. Now, let's translate that to last minute registration and look at our neighbor in Washington State, mm-hmm. the fiasco that they've just gone through.
And
where
they don't have same-day registration in Washington, right?
No.
Okay.
So that's my point there is look at the fiasco they had up there and where a judge's ruling said, yes, they were illegal votes, but you have no proof that it was done fraudulently. We still, in Oregon, would have no way of proving fraud. So let's do a good job of voter registration sanctifying by 21 days the way it is in the Constitution now and not go backwards to create a fiasco. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for the panel?
No, I just, what's interesting to note that those other states don't have vote by mail either.
That's correct.
A 3-week voting period.
That's correct.
Which also adds to the anonymity and the difficulty in verifying whether John Brown is really John Brown.
Thank you. All right. Any other questions? Thank you very much. We really appreciate you joining us this morning.
Thank you for that.
Okay, we're going to close a public hearing on SJR 10. I'm sorry, and open the work session on SJR 10. The chair would move SJR 10 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Madam Chairman, I'm compelled to believe that this is not a good idea. And what compels me to believe that is the mechanical separation of the secrecy envelope from the ballot, which can never be rejoined again, and the recent decision in Washington State that indicates that the difficulty in demonstrating fraudulent intent virtually makes the challenge of elections, at least under their system, impossible. I'm not sure the same thing wouldn't happen here. I believe that it's naive of us to assume that voter fraud does not occur. I think it's much more reasonable to believe voter fraud's probably attended every election since the beginning of elections by secret ballot. It's just inherent in our system. It's so competitive, and the outcomes are so important to people, that winning by any means is sometimes the last resort. The Constitution's clear. We need a 6-month residency period and 21 days. To move to a same-day registration seems to me to invite people to recruit busloads of voters to go and cast their ballots in particular elections. The additional troublesome aspect of this is that we do get daily counts of voters who cast their ballots. You know by name which voters have turned in their ballots and which have not, and that is converted into a cottage industry of calling people and offering to transport either them or their ballot to a mailbox, maybe even assisting them in voting. It would seem to me to be a relatively simple extrapolation to decide how many Republicans have turned in their ballots and how many Democrats have turned in their ballots, and then recruit the appropriate number of voters to register the same day to cast a ballot. And that could, in fact, have an effect on an election. I understand the impulse to try to broaden voter participation. I think we can achieve that objective through better education and more vigorous outreach to citizens without jeopardizing the sanctity and the security of the voter system. It seems to me that it has a credibility problem already, and this deepens the credibility problem. So, Madam Chairman, I'll be voting no, and I'll be urging my colleagues to vote no, and I would join with any member of this committee in opposing the bill, even to the point of a minority report.
All right.
Shocking, I know.
I know.
Minority report?
Sorry.
No, it's drastic.
I see both sides of the issue, but I'm happy to support the chair today. I don't think we're going to find more fraud one way or the other. I mean, there are advantages to both sides. It's been a long time since we originally heard the bill, but there was a lot of good information, a lot of good reasons why we should do it, presented that day, and today some alarm bells have gone off. So how do you weigh it? Thank you, Madam Chair.
And just to clarify, for the record, the 6 months residency requirement that's still currently in Oregon's Constitution was overridden by the U.S. Supreme Court several years ago, so that no longer is legally valid. So, anything else, Senator Ringo?
Madam Chair, I will vote yes as a courtesy to get out of the committee. I have some concerns about this as well. I think people need to take voting very seriously. And I'd like to think that means getting engaged 21 days ahead so that they can register 21 days ahead rather than just, oh, gee, today I think I might vote, so what the heck, I'll go register and vote. But I am willing to give this a courtesy yes to get it out of committee.
Thank you. Sarah,
Madam Chair,
you wish to give a speech, too?
No, not
okay.
Speech.
All right.
I'll be voting no, and I will be already serving notice of a minority report.
Okay. So noted for the record.
The problem with this is that the burden of proof is going to be on whoever feels that an injustice has been done. So it's their burden to rack up lawyer bills. It's their burden to sue the state. And those are overcomeable. Those are odds that nobody can win. I remember during the 2000 election when it was whether the Bush attorneys were going to sue in what state. It's an overwhelming amount of legal expense that you can't sue the king and win. And so that's why I'll be voting no and try to give this bill a little purpose.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Atkinson. And for the record, that's actually true now, is that the burden is on the complainant in terms of the system. So this bill does not change that. All right. Would you please call the roll, Ms. Gatto?
Senator Atkinson?
No.
Senator Ringo?
Aye.
Senator Shields?
Aye.
Senator
Farioli?
No.
Chair votes aye. And Senator Atkinson and Senator Farioli have served notice of minority report. Thank you very much. Next up, we'd like to do Senate Bill 818. I'm going to move into work session. Mr. Johnson, did you want to come forward, or are you just like a willing member of the audience today? Come on up. Would you remind us what the bill does, Ms. Harris?
Sure. Thanks, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 818 directs the Department of Human Services to administer a pilot program that would enable certain human services clients to access faith-based or community organizations for assistance.
All right. Mr. Johnson, welcome. We appreciate you joining us in front of Senate Rules today.
Madam Chair, Senators, this is my first opportunity to appear before a substantive committee this session, and it's a pleasure to be in front of this one. Very nice to see you all. My name is Brian Johnston. I'm the Interim Director of the Department of Human Services. I'm here to support Senate Bill 818. Senate Bill 818 is the child of Senate Bill 886, which passed in the 03 session, and it created a pilot program. This pilot program authorized DHS to inquire whether an individual might be interested in, and if he or she was, to refer them to a faith-based or community-based organization. The pilot program, the site that was selected was Coos County and Curry County. Those might not have been the most ideal sites for a pilot program that needs a lot of community-based organizations, needs a lot of faith-based organizations in order to work. So what Senator Shields did was bring this bill back in an attempt to amend the pilot nature to include possibly another program. That's what this bill does. There were some concerns by certain segments of the community who watch our actions carefully, and they met with the senator and were able to work out their concerns, and we remain in support of the bill.
Great. Thank you. Questions for Mr. Johnson? No questions? You're welcome. Senator Shields.
Just a quick comment. I just want to be very forthcoming, and I hope the committee members hear me. On the dash four amendments, the ACLU was very helpful in writing kind of what's needed in a report. We didn't have that in the original bill. And so we never really got the kind of report we needed. In fact, we've never had a final report on the original pilot project down in Coos Bay. We really do think we need kind of a more typical area to do a pilot in, and that's what these amendments are about. Remember the vision behind it. It's just connecting people with their faith or community-based community when they've already gone to DHS. So I want to thank ACLU and everybody else that participated in making this a better bill.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Shields. We really appreciate their participation. All right. Anything else? We're in work session. Senator Shields.
Yes, I'd like to move the -4 amendments to Senate Bill 818.
Okay. All right. Senator Shields has moved the -84 amendments to Senate Bill 818. Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none? So ordered. Senator Shields.
Madam Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 818 as amended to the floor of the Senate with the due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Shields has moved the 818 as amended with the -4 amendments to the Senate floor with due pass recommendation. We do not have a fiscal on this. It's been our practice. If we do receive a fiscal with a cost of over $50,000, the bill will go to the Senate Budget Committee. We do not believe that will be the case with this bill, but so for the time being, we'll send it to the Senate floor. Any further discussion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing, seeing none, so ordered. Senator Shields, you get to be the lucky carrier. All right, let's move back up to House Bill 3329. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us a little bit about the bill? This is going to be a public hearing only. The amendments are not ready. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. House Bill 3329A requires that group health insurance policies that cover hospital, medical, or surgical costs also make payments for service to registered nurse first assistants.
Thank you. Good morning and welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Brown, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martin Taylor. I'm here representing the Oregon Nurses Association and a national group called AORN, which represents perioperative nurses around the country. This is a bill that actually has been remarkably not controversial or difficult. We sat down very early in the process with Senator Bates and John Powell and had a discussion about the value of reimbursing RNFAs for their work, and Senator Bates and Mr. Powell helped us craft some amendments to make the bill a little bit more comfortable for them. We worked with the Board of Nursing on the outside to make them a little bit more comfortable, but after a little amending, we came up with a bill that got unanimous support both at the committee and on the floor level in the House, and we're bringing it to you today with an explanation from an RNFA named Deb Castle.
Thanks, and welcome this morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I appreciate the opportunity to share with you some of my thoughts on House Bill 3329. Most of you may know me as president of the Oregon Nurses Association, but in my regular life, I'm a certified registered nurse first assist. And to give you a little bit of background for those who don't know, an RNFA is a nurse who's gone back to school for advanced training specifically in surgical assisting. Our state being rural as it is, there are many instances where a second surgeon is not available to assist in surgery, and we have that specific training to fill that need. What has happened is, for the last 30 years or so, RNFAs have been recognized providers by insurance companies for reimbursement because of situations in different states. What has happened is we have never been in Medicare statute. And the last 5 or 6 years, insurance companies realizing this have now decided that being we're not in Medicare statute, there's no reason for them to have to pay for the services of an RNFA. 8 years ago, Congress mandated that AORN do a study to see what the fiscal impact or savings would be for RNFAs to put them into Medicare statute. What came out of that study was that we were not only budget neutral, but we were actually a cost savings to the Medicare industry because of the reimbursement rates that were currently paid. When that came forward to Congress, they decided that it at that point was too old a study and again mandated another study to MedPAC to again find out if we met reimbursement criteria for those who are already currently being reimbursed. What they found was that we had the same training, the same credentialing, but they were neutral on whether or not to support reimbursement. So that's where we sit nationally. But what has happened is insurance companies over the years have cited following Medicare guidelines. So those who paid for an assist, which is allowed through their policies, are now saying, even though we do allow payment for an assist, we will not pay you because you're not in Medicare statute. Okay. So the last two or three years, over a dozen states have passed legislation requiring third-party reimbursement so that those of us who were being paid prior to the change in the insurance industry will again be paid for our services. Do you have any questions?
Matt, thank you for your testimony. The question that occurs to me is, if you're not paid, there will be certain places where they'll opt to try and get a second surgeon into the scenario, which would cost more money. Why would the insurance companies want to go that route?
Senator Brown, Senator Shields, I actually think that's exactly what brings John Powell and Blue Cross Blue Shield to the table, that they are, in fact, reimbursing, and his company is, and I think they recognize that you're going to have someone in the assist role. The real question is competence and cost. You have a level of competence in an RNFA that is effective for these surgeries, but your costs are much lower than they are if you have a second surgeon or a PA. So there is actually a real value to the insurance industry in encouraging more RNFAs to move into this field. And we heard from a surgeon on the House side who essentially said, look, we don't want to do second surgeries because compared to what a surgeon makes doing the first role, it's almost 20% of what the performing surgeon is making. We can really make more money doing something else with our time performing as a second surgeon. So in rural areas where you have a shortage of surgeons, this is a particularly big problem from an access to care perspective too. So we really haven't found anybody yet to bring us an objection to this good idea. It's mostly a question of trying to correct what is seen on a national level as kind of a loophole to the payment of people for their service.
It occurs to me, Madam Chair, that if it's taken me almost 5 minutes to figure out that this is a no-brainer, that the federal government should have figured it out by now.
You would have thought.
I mean, seriously.
And currently, as Martin said, a second surgeon receives 20% reimbursement of the original surgeon's fee. What an RNFA or a PA, a physician's assistant, makes, you'll probably want to write this down. It's in the testimony that I gave you. We make between 13 and 20% of the 20% billed. That's our current reimbursement rate. And you also have Dr. Stephen Newman's testimony. I brought that with me so that you could see what he testified on the House side from his perspective.
We love you, Senator Farrielli.
Two things. First of all, this devolves to a scope of practice issue. That's the only thing I can say here. That the nurse practitioners that are qualified to assist in surgery are being viewed as interlopers into the domain of the surgeon. Mm-hmm. And that may have translated itself into the lack of a regulation in the federal statutes. We should correct it. So let's agree with Senator Shields.
Are you okay if we wait till we have some amendments?
Sure.
Okay.
The other thing, Madam Chairman, is I'm happy to report I may have a conflict of interest here. My daughter's in nursing school, and she's decided to specialize in this field.
Oh, wow.
Excellent. Great. Excellent. Great. There really aren't enough of us out there. It's happening on a daily basis. We do not have the luxury of having enough doctors in the state to treat people, let alone enough assistants. Yeah. So that's wonderful.
That's great.
Give her my best and good wishes.
Well,
okay.
Senator
Mr. Taylor.
Brown, members of the committee, I look forward to representing Senator Fieldy's daughter in the future. And I
we can
also
only hope it would be true justice if she becomes an ONA member, a member of the union.
Be careful what you wish for, Senator Brown. So.
Each person has to find their own way.
I think she could be influential in our organization, and who knows where that will lead. So I would say only that the amendments shouldn't be controversial either. They're technically just going to relink this bill back to the insurance code. I think we inadvertently in our amendments in the House side took out a reference to an RS that hooks this to the enforcement in the insurance division. So the insurance division actually brought amendments to us saying, if you really want this enforced, you should hook us back in. So, yeah.
All right, Mr. Taylor, well, I'll make sure that you ride herd. I'll put the ball in your court in terms of riding herd on the amendments and making sure that Mr. Powell and whoever else needs to see the amendments before we adopt them do that. So I'd like to get this back on the agenda for next week. So.
Yeah.
All right, so much for your time. Thank you. Appreciate you joining us today. Okay, with that, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3329 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 578. Ms. Harris, why don't you tell us what we have? And I suspect that the crowd is due to this particular bill.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Committee, Senate Bill 578 makes certain findings concerning international outsourcing of services, and it requires contractors who submit bids or proposals on public contracts to certify that services would not be performed overseas or outsourced.
Okay, we're looking for Mr. Nesbitt or Mr. Przanski. That'd be great. Yeah. Do you see Nesbitt out there?
He should be arriving momentarily.
Okay. All right.
Floyd.
Senator Przanski.
Oh.
All right. Well, tell him we're going to bring up the opponents. Right. Thank you. Mr. Craven, Mr. Schweinhardt, and Mr. Cosgrove.
You know what I call them?
I'm afraid to. You know what I call them?
Yeah.
It's Pretty Boy Floyd.
It's Pretty Boy Floyd.
There's Mr. Nesbitt.
Oh, sorry, guys. Do you mind if the proponent comes up first? Thanks. I appreciate that. Mr. Lanning, are you going to join him? Okay. He might need...
You might need some help.
Protection. Is that what we're doing? I was going to say protection.
I thought I'd have colleagues on my left and my right, but I'm happy to...
Senator Przanski will be here in a minute.
Okay. Chair Brown, members of the committee, I'm Tim Nesbitt, president of the Oregon AFL-CIO, and I believe you have amendments to Senate Bill 578 to consider, and they take us in a different direction to address the same problem that was identified in the original bill, and that is the problem that arises when state-funded services are shifted to providers beyond our borders or, in some cases, overseas. The original bill said the state shouldn't do that absent extraordinary circumstances. This bill says let's look at that problem case by case and ask ourselves the question, when should services for our citizens funded by our taxpayers be shifted to providers outside our borders or, in many cases, overseas? And ask potential bidders on service contracts to identify the number of people they expect to employ, a minimum number, and the amount of payroll they expect to have within the state of Oregon. And then allows the state to take into consideration the benefits that would accrue from having those jobs here in Oregon, those workers here in Oregon paying taxes here in Oregon, in order to make a case-by-case determination of whether the service is better provided in-state or out-of-state. And again, this is not about public works or construction projects, which are covered by a whole other set of laws. This is about contracts for services, which are bid case-by-case. Secondly, there are other kinds of service contracts which by necessity are performed within our borders. Think of landscaping or janitorial work. And those are simply done on a lowest responsible bid basis. And so a second part of this amendment addresses a minimum standard of compensation for those kinds of contractors. So they're all competing equally and encouraged to be paying a fair wage with benefits. So that's the thrust of the new amendments. It takes a approach based on the carrot rather than the stick. It allows you to do case-by-case determinations. It asks of your bidders what I think you should be asking of all your potential bidders, and that is, what jobs and at what pay levels will you be providing here in Oregon? Because that's an important part of the calculation we believe you should be making when you decide how this work is to be performed. Senator Przanski has joined me, and he has He was the sponsor of the bill and is promoting the amendments. And by the way, this proposal comes from a task force. So the governor convened as early as last summer, and we worked it through with representatives of the employer community as well as others. We don't have complete agreement from those who are on the task force. We all did our best job to kind of tackle this problem, and I think the product here speaks for itself. I think it's a better approach to tackling this problem.
Thank you. Before you get started, Ms. Brzezinski, Senator Brzezinski, Mr. Nesbitt, this is really annoying. We're going to kick you out, man. How long have proponents seen the amendments? Did they just come out today?
Oh, they've been out for over a month.
All right. Yes. Did you hear that? Senator Brzezinski.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. I'm here also in support of the Dash 1 amendments for Senate Bill 578, which presents in State Senator District 4. As Mr. Nesbitt has said, this is really an incentive-based type of approach, and it's one of the things I think we've all have looked at. Instead of having, let's call them penalty points, wherever you can be incentively driven to get individuals to invest more in Oregon is the way to go. And this actually does do that, and I won't belabor the points that Mr. Nesbitt's already gone over, but by providing for this type of criteria, it will in fact allow the state, when they are going out to bid for these type of service contracts, to look at what is the benefit of the money that's going to be spent up from Oregon and where it's actually going to end up. I can tell you from my campaign trails and being in all parts of my district, from the urban to the rural, when you talked about outsourcing of Oregon jobs, use of Oregon funds, tax dollars to pay for services that were actually being provided for and by individuals outside of the state, if not out of the country, really caused a lot of people concern and scratching their heads. So this is, I think, an approach that will, in fact, allow for the state to be able to take in consideration where that the dollars that they will be spending for the services will be actually utilized and spent. And as we all know, every dollar that we can spend within a community in Oregon is going to manifest the viability and livability of those communities. And so I think it's real important for us to do whatever we can. And I would agree with Mr. Nesbitt. This carrot approach is the way to go as compared to trying to, let's say, penalize someone for not complying. This really gives the incentive for individuals, if they want to come from out of state and provide a service, to actually establish themselves in the state, having workers within the state. And I think we could say, in my opinion, this would be a true win-win.
Okay. Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate you joining us this morning. All right. Now the opponents, Mr. Craven, Mr. Schweinhart, and Mr. Cosgrove.
Morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Jim Craven representing the American Electronics Association. Senate Bill 578, as originally printed, I think we're not debating here today. We had a very brief hearing on that in Senator Shields' committee a couple months ago. I think it lasted 10 or 15 minutes, and I think everyone agreed that a blanket prohibition on a company being able to bid on a contract for the state of Oregon if they did any work overseas was probably unconstitutional and had all kinds of problems. And so we're now really debating what's the content of the Dash 1 amendments. I think this is certainly a subject worthy of consideration, no doubt about that. I guess my basic point to you today is this opens up really big issues in Oregon's public contracting law at a very late time in the session and on issues that really have not been vetted, have not had significant stakeholder involvement to date. So I think it is a major rewrite or major new provisions in Oregon's public contracting law. I'm not exactly sure what the problem statement is that we're addressing. I understand the sort of the general issue, but I'm not sure that we have seen a statement of a problem that vast amounts of Oregon public contracting has gone outside the state rather than inside the state, and any kind of really statistical or data-driven information that helps us make a rational decision about this proposal. We've just completed a multi-year rewrite of Oregon's public contracting laws. I'm not sure if any of you were intimately involved in that in the 2003 session, but a number of people were, probably the 2001 session, and an exhaustive public rulemaking during the interim with a law that really just went into effect, I think, in March of this year as a result of what this assembly did last session. So we're really talking about yet a whole new overlay to something that has just been settled, at least for the time being, in state law. The amendments proposed here do two major things. One, on complex bids, so-called sealed proposals, RFP types of proposals, it really tries to introduce a new concept of in-state preference in the bidding process. Now, that's, I think, a subject that is worthy of consideration, but there are risks to doing that, and one of the major...
Jim, yes. I'm not that familiar with public contracting, but my recollection is that some areas of the industry have a preference already. Like, I'm thinking of the printing statutes that we provide a preference to in-state companies.
Correct? Senator Brown, I'm aware of two specific preferences. One is printing, and that's a long-standing. I don't know the history of it. Number two, I think, is license plates, and some of you may recall that from
that
last
one.
Session.
And I can even give you the bill number.
I'm sure you can. The problem with in-state preferences, of course, is that you risk retaliatory preferences by other states. I mean, Oregon companies, a number of Oregon companies, whether they're in the high-tech field, engineering services, financial services, legal services, provide and bid on contracts in other states. And basically, the way this interstate thing goes is that if one state provides preferences, the other state often will retaliate in terms of negative preferences against our people. So while we're trying to, and I think worthy, trying to direct more work on state bids to in-state contractors, the negative risk that we run is that our own companies, who often are multi-state and global, run the risk of having retaliatory preferences applied against them in other states. And so it's a big issue that this bill raises, and I think it needs additional discussion. The bill proposes to ask people who are companies who are bidding on complex personal services contracts to provide a so-called personnel deployment plan. It says that at the time I'm bidding on a contract with the state of Oregon, I need to tell the state how many workers are going to work on the bid, on the job, where they're going to be working, what kind of pay they're going to receive, and how many workers and what kind of pay are going to be received in the state of Oregon. And again, while a legitimate issue and a worthy issue to have a discussion about, some of the problems of this that rise up are in a company's bidding on a contract in the state of Oregon may not know at the time of bid really how they're going to deploy their resources to meet the demands of that contract. Say a multi-year contract to rewrite the software system for the state of Oregon, for instance. This would require at the time you bid to say, I'm going to have this many workers in Oregon, they're going to be paid this much money, I'm going to have other workers elsewhere. And that becomes an enforceable terms over the life of the contract. And a company may, for legitimate business reasons, redeploy resources during the life of a contract. And so it adds a whole new complex thing that you're supposed to estimate or guess, I guess, at the time of bid, where your people are going to be and how much you're going to pay them over the life of the contract. And this does add a level of complexity that is difficult, I think, for some firms to meet. The other issue in the bill, which we really don't have a dog in this fight, is a whole new concept of minimum living wage, for instance. And you know you've heard of this in some of the cities. I think City of Portland, perhaps, maybe Eugene, have introduced this concept that says when we're going to outsource a janitorial contract, a contract to mow the lawns, whatever, the private sector bidder must pay a certain amount. And that concept is in these dash ones, too. It's $10.15 an hour, including wages and benefits and such. Again, we don't have a real issue with that, but it is a substantial new issue of statewide so-called minimum living wage on all private sector contracts that I want to make sure you're aware. That's what you're being asked to support in this bill. So finally, I guess my summary is that we have seen an earlier draft of this. It was shared with us 4 or 5 weeks ago. We attended a couple of meetings. I don't think I was part of what you'd call task force, but Tom Chamberlain from the governor's office, Mr. Nesbitt, we did have a couple of discussions about basically what's in these dash ones. We're willing to continue to look at this issue. We can't support them as they're currently drafted, and I do think it's rather late in the session for a very substantial public contracting overlay that's represented in Senate Bill 578.
Thank you. Mr. Craven, before, can we get the whole panel before we take any questions? And I did want to recognize we've got a few folks, a few young people from the Oregon Youth Challenge Program. Are you all just visiting the Capitol today?
Yes.
Well, welcome. Hope you enjoy your experience. I think I need some help with you on my caucus members. Mr. Cosgrove?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
It's an inside joke.
She'll stop and explain it later.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman and members of the committee. Paul Cosgrove representing Hewlett-Packard and the Oregon Financial Services Association. I would second Mr. Craven's comments. I was involved in one meeting about a month or so ago, but I actually didn't see these amendments, not that they are terribly surprising to me, until yesterday morning. I agree that this is a significant concern. Let me give you an example that doesn't come from either of those two clients, if I may, about the kind of problem that Mr. Craven suggested might occur with someone bidding on a complex project. The state has just let an RFP, and in fact the responses are in and the state's evaluating them to redo the Medicaid Management Information System, a huge multi-million dollar system with many complexities. The RFP itself doesn't specify it is to be developed as part of the RFP process by the bidder exactly what that system will be. It's literally impossible for a contractor with that kind of contract, and those are common and appropriate kinds of contracts, to set a minimum commitment and agree to live by that commitment through the life of a multi-year contract, because the project isn't even yet specified. It is to be specified. The second thing is, as I mentioned in front of Senate Shields Committee, and it's also something Mr. Craven testified on, and here I have my financial services hat on, Oregon is the substantial insourcing place for a number of financial services. One of the members of the Oregon Financial Services is a bank that used to be called Hong Kong and Shanghai Bank. It's not headquartered in Hong Kong or Shanghai. It's headquartered in London with its major base of operations in Albany, New York, and they have insourced 1,300 people to Tigard. There is a problem in this economy and in this world economy with setting barriers around our state, because it has impacts on the ability to get those kinds of jobs into the state of Oregon. And then finally, with respect to the invitation to bid, although I didn't mention on the sign-up sheet, I represent Addus Healthcare. It's a major contractor with State Department of Human Services for home health care services. We're, in fact, in negotiations as we speak, as is the state, with home health service workers on compensation. What the invitation to bid with the minimum family wage, minimum living wage kind of concept does is say, that's what our contract will be, and not later than September 30th of every year, DAS will evaluate and adjust that. It sort of raises major concerns about how you bid on a union contract and how a union and an employer can make those kinds of agreements and then have DAS step in and adjust them. So I think there are problems as well with that invitation to bid process, the one that deals with the kinds of, as Mr. Craven said, landscaping and those kinds of contracts, but it also deals with a lot of major contracts that this state enters into with people, particularly through DHS. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Schweinhart.
Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Joe Schweinhart, Associated Oregon Industries. I'm just not going to echo what the two other gentlemen here have said, except to say that we agree with what they're saying. The only thing I would add is that this amendment would limit competition, make bidding more complex and costly in a time when we're trying to squeeze every dollar we can out of the budget. We're finding a way to conceivably spend the money when we don't have to. We can make this a cheaper process. And we oppose the amendment. Thank you. Madam Chair,
Jim Craven,
just one further point I neglected to mention. In current Oregon contracting law, public contracting law, we do have an in-state preference that works like this, that basically says when people are bidding on work with the state of Oregon, if all things are equal, and all things are often not equal, but all things equal, similar service, similar price, similar addressing the needs of the state, we do provide a preference to an in-state bidder. So we have a framework now that says if the main issue on public contracting, I believe, is that the needs of the state get accomplished at the best price for the taxpayer. I mean, I think that's what's driven our public contracting law for a long, long time. We do say if all those things are equal and the bidder happens to be from Portland rather than Pocatello, let's give it to the Portland bidder. So we do have a framework now that tries to, you know, give a slight preference to an Oregon bidder. This goes way beyond that to open a whole other issue that we think needs substantial work.
Thanks, Mr. Craven. I guess what I sort of wrestle with, and it was the whole, I think it was the Senate Bill 899, the licensing, the license plate bill, Irwin-Hodson Company, and the fact that State Department of Motor Vehicles was saving $600,000 by having the licenses printed by a Nova Scotia firm, whereas Irwin-Hodson was laying off 10 or 15 people. And I think the question is, where is the line, and how do we wrestle with that, and is that, you know, a policy decision for the legislature? Is that an executive branch? You know, how do you determine that? And at the same time, several months later, we heard that Department of Human Services had contracted with a company that was contracting with a firm from India to respond to phone calls to DHS. I mean, it's like, you know, it's really a difficult subject, I think, in terms of where do you draw the line.
Madam Chair, I don't argue at all that it's a difficult issue that's worthy of substantial consideration and debate. I do want to add the second issue referred to, the company named eFunds, which administers the Oregon Trail Card, mm-hmm. which is the card that is used, you've seen it, looks like a credit card, is used for food stamps and other services. That company, I believe the state of Oregon did adjust that contract, and eFunds, in response to pressure, as it were, or request from a number of states, because it does a lot of these contracts from the country, has, I think, in many cases, brought those call center activities back to the United States. So I think that's the one specific issue that I've heard of, other than license plates, and I think it has been addressed. So.
Okay, thanks. Senator Farrelly,
Senator
Shields.
I really appreciate the discussion that we've had today, and I understand completely the motivation and the impulse to stop outsourcing. You know, this is a very tough environment that we're living in, and the transition to a global economy has been brutal. You know, and I've seen it in communities that depend on forest product manufacturing and agricultural production and others, as we've watched labor costs become the dominant driver of outsourcing issues. And even though I understand that impulse and would love to be able to figure out how to rebalance this process, trade barriers fail almost always because of the unintended consequences. You just can't build the wall high enough to keep your workers captive or to prevent them from having to compete in a global economy. None of that's going to work. If this were a resolution that didn't require us to do anything, it would adequately express our angst, because that's about all you can do is say, this is a tough deal. But to try to put in statute escalators for wages, hours, and benefits, and to eliminate or to try to eliminate competition, it's like trying to legislate morality. You know, it might make you feel better. It might be a good gesture in terms of a statement to make to a group of people that you're commiserating with. But at the end of the day, it fails on a policy basis because, you know, as the French found in World War II, you can build the Maginot Line, you just can't defend it. People go around it. And that's what this legislation tries to do, is try to build an imaginary wall, and people would just ignore it or go around it, or it'll drive our competitiveness away. I don't think it goes anywhere.
Thank you, Senator Farrioli. Senator Shields.
I'm listening to Senator Farrioli and to both of you, Jim and Paul. I think you make a great statement about the complexity of the issue, and I agree with you. Senator Farrioli or myself, either one, if we had a company in our district that all of a sudden was laying off 25 or 50 or 100 workers because jobs had been outsourced, would have a not only an intellectual exercise, what we would have would be a political problem. And so I don't think that the governor's office wants to quit dealing with the issue because there is a political problem. Senator Prasansky said it very well when he said he goes around a district and all you got to do is say outsourcing and nobody's going to be listening to your rational conversation anymore. You know, the second they say that word, people are angry. They're shipping our jobs to China or they're shipping our jobs to India. How do you deal with this political problem? I mean, I understand all the intellectual arguments, but how do you deal with this political problem that we have? Our citizens don't like it.
Madam Chair, Senator Shields, you're absolutely right. I think what we are doing as AEA at the national level is trying to raise this level of debate, and it's the same issue that's brought up in Thomas Friedman's new book, The World is Flat. The world is flat, or flat world, the world is flat. The issue, I think this country needs to get serious about competing, and I think that is the only way to address the challenge. I think the genie is out of the bag. When Craig Barrett, the CEO of Intel, was in Portland last year, he said what we haven't quite reckoned with yet is the fact that in a very short period of time, just a decade, somewhere on the order of 3 billion people have entered the international global capitalistic society. If you include former Soviet Union, India, and China, there are 3 billion people competing with Americans now. Now, obviously, they're not all high-skilled, high-wage people. But what I think sometimes we fail to recognize is that a whole lot of them are. And that this issue of global sourcing is not just an issue of chasing very low wages in countries where they'll put something together or glue things or assemble stuff. This is the leading graduator of electrical engineers in the world today is China, at 4 times the rate of the United States. The United States continues to produce fewer computer scientists, electrical engineers, than they did 20, 30 years ago. I think some of the things we're doing in the very small world of Oregon, and we obviously can't address this ourselves, but Oregon is one of the few states that actually is going the opposite direction, that actually is graduating more technology workers than we were 10 years ago. That's part of the whole e-tech process and the investments that you have made on a sustained period for the last decade. We are one of the few states in the country that's producing more engineers and more computer scientists, while most states are going the other direction. So I think, you know, it is complex. And it gets down, if you lose jobs in your district, it's a visceral issue that is very difficult to deal with by talking about competitiveness and long-term investments in higher education and all that. I do think that's the answer. It's not an easy one to deal with on a political basis.
Right.
But I think it needs to be at least thrown in. It may not be a silver bullet for you in the moment of a crisis, but to say that the way to address this issue is for America to get serious. America right now, the federal government, has continued to disinvest in research and development over the last 20 years. The only thing that we grow in the federal budget is investment in health sciences. And again, that's great. We're going to have people live longer lives and cure end-of-life diseases. But what are we going to do about them in the previous 80 years? We continue to slash federal investment in the National Science Foundation and in the kinds of things that brought us the internet, that brought us global positioning systems, that brought us all those inventions we take for granted today. Those came from federal investments that we are disinvesting in.
Mm-hmm.
So,
Mr. Cosgrove, did you want to respond? And then I think Senator Farrelly only wants to respond. And then I think we need to move on to the next issue.
Madam Chair, I'll be very brief. On maybe a more localized level, it seems to me that if a company is making a decision to do that, there's likely a reason. Companies don't shut plants, walk away from capital investments, and lay off workers because they think that's fun. They do it because there's a reason. And I think that the two examples that have been discussed so far today, there was a problem identified and a solution that was specific to that problem addressed. In one case, I guess it was essentially job owning, brought the contract back, and whether it took legislation, I think that's far more likely to be a successful method to address the real concerns in your communities is to try to identify what's the problem in this particular case and try to address that problem rather than the rather sweeping and complex things that this amendment do. These amendments do. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Schreinhart, and then Senator Farrelly.
Just one comment. I think you'll find that outsourcing isn't the largest problem we have. Yes, there is outsourcing. The real problem is how do we stop it from continuing? And we need to do things at home.
Thank you.
Madam Chair,
Senator Farrelly.
Just in regarding the world is flat, the author was sharing some observations about what factors are flattening the world and leveling the playing field. One of his observations were that a decade ago or more, we used to buy the brains from the international market. People would come here because they could make more money here. Their economies hadn't grown to the point where we were at a competitive disadvantage. And so the objective of a lot of the folks that graduated from technical and engineering and high technology venues was to get to America so that they could take advantage of what was happening here. Today in India, there are 350 million people that meet the definition of our middle class. They're comparable in economic ability to our middle class. People don't have to move anymore. And what's happening is that their economies are expanding rapidly. We're not going to see the brain drain to the U.S. as we did before. Those folks are in place growing their economies exponentially. And I think that's one of the things that's causing some of the angst that we're having here. And I agree with these guys. I think the competition question is the big one.
Well, the other, and Mr. Schreinhart, I heard what you said, and I guess what I wrestle with is, you know, at the same time, we as legislators are, under extreme pressure to increase the efficiency and reduce the cost of government in order to provide the same level of services that we provided for the last, 150 years, only do it cheaper, better, et cetera. And at some level, that's going to have to do, there's going to have to be some outsourcing for that to happen. I mean, I'm sorry.
And Madam Chair, let me also say that business is under the same situation.
Totally.
They've got to do it better and faster and cheaper,
yep,
because they're in a global economy.
Yeah. All right. Well, this has been a very interesting conversation. I'd love to continue it. We appreciate you joining us. We have one last witness, or at least one on the sheet. Ms. Lancaster from the Department of Administrative Services. Anybody else wishing to testify? Oregon Youth Challenge members, you guys want to come up and give your 2 cents worth? No, ma'am. Okay. Thank you very much. Good luck in your work. I think the art caucuses can use a little help from them. Hi, welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak today. I'm Diane Lancaster for the State Procurement Office at the Department of Administrative Services. I'm submitting a brief testimony on the Dash 1 amendments. The policy discussion, of course, is interesting and complex. From the operational perspective, we wanted to let you know that the bill as amended would be doable. We can even bring it in for a fairly modest fiscal impact, and I have with me two attorneys from the Department of Justice who would be available for any questions you would have on legal issues.
Thank you.
Basically, we're just here in case.
Saying you're neutral is great. Thank you.
Thank you.
Neutral is originally drafted.
No, neutral.
Opposed is a neutral. No, gotcha. Okay. So here's a question for you.
Yes, sir.
And I think this illustrates the issue that Senator Brown was discussing earlier. When my office telephone rings in somebody else's free exchange, the signature telephone number is 360. That prefix is in Washington State. Oh. Tell me how that happens.
Senator Farrioli, I would have to do some research on that. I'm not sure.
Okay.
All but right. We'd be happy to follow up with your office. It.
We outsourced the telephone exchange to a Washington carrier because it was cheaper.
I see.
Okay.
All right. So
thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else here present wishing to testify on Senate Bill 578? Hearing and seeing none, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 578. The committee will be at ease momentarily while we reassemble a quorum for a work session on a Senate Bill 10. Which is it? Can 62. Thank you. We're in recess.
62. Any of you wonderful members in the audience interested in testifying on this bill? No. We're going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1062, open a work session on Senate Bill 1062. Ms. Harris, what do we got?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senate Bill 1062 amends the public records laws to create uniform standards for record retention for members of the Legislative Assembly.
All right, and we have the Dash 1 amendments. Senator Farrioli, I know we're kind of stalling in hopes that Senator Atkinson shows up.
Well, Madam Chairman, I don't think that's necessary at
okay.
all, but I would like to just make a couple of comments
please.
On the record, and then we can move forward with my no vote.
Okay.
First of all, I think this brings us into an area of complexity that may be very difficult for us to extract ourselves from, if I may end with a proposition. And for instance, we're going to have pretty good definitions about what are public records and what are not.
That is correct, Senator Farrioli.
And, I've had some discussions with legislative counsel about what is and what isn't, and I think there's some differing opinions. For instance, any note or any document or any communication that is dispository or that helps a legislator come to a conclusion about a piece of legislation or helps them make a decision could in fact become a public record, could be a public record, and subject not only to disclosure but to retention. The good senator and I have discussed oftentimes about this issue, and I've tried to get a bead on the question of when files are confidential and when they are not. Personal documents are not subject to disclosure or retention. We often receive confidential communications from constituents, and they may or may not be subject to disclosure depending on how they're used. For instance, I had some communications that were of a confidential nature relative to directors of various agencies over the years, and those directors were eventually removed from office. And relating to some of the issues that were discussed in those communications. Did that communication create or precipitate, or was it pre-decisional, or was it used in a decision-making basis? All of those questions have to be analyzed. I believe our staff people are going to be now subject to the potential prosecution by third parties if they make mistakes. And this doesn't just subject the member to the requirements of disclosure and retention. Staff members, committee staff members, legislative staff folks, even aides, possibly even volunteers in our office, would now be subject to prosecution if they make an error on whether or not a document is retainable or whether or not it's disclosable. Madam Chair, there's a better way to solve the problem, and that is that the Legislative Assembly may be subject to retention and disclosure laws, but I don't believe that it's necessary to make legislators subject to disclosure and retention. So I would suggest that this Senate Bill 1062 needs a great deal more study and a great deal more disclosure and a lot more work on the definitions of what is and what isn't retainable before we move forward. And that would be my statement on 1062, Madam Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Farrioli. And for once, I cannot disagree with anything you say. This is the approach that the Senate leadership has chosen to take. The leadership felt like it was inappropriate for the Legislative Assembly to be exempted from the Public Records Act. So we tried to craft a proposal that was as narrow as possible. We anticipate the House will hopefully have this conversation and may wrestle with this issue further. But I think your points are well taken. Any other comments? Chair would move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 1062. Do you want to object to the dash ones?
Madam Chairman, I don't need to object to
okay.
the dash ones.
All right. No objection to the dash one amendments to 1062. They're adopted. Chair would move Senate Bill 1062 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Senator Shields.
I would simply hope that you would carry the bill when it's there because I think it's complex and you understand better than the rest of it.
Thanks, Senator Shields. Senator Farrioli would be noted as an objection. Did you want to do a minority report?
No.
Okay. All right. No minority report. And with that, the motion is adopted, and I will carry Senate Bill 1062 as amended. No, I want this note for posterity. And
it's a public record.
If there is any other business to come before the committee, we're adjourned.
The record show.
Thanks, everybody. I don't have it with me, but I know what it is.
No,
I know, but we ran it out. We're not, you know what? We may have to come back tomorrow then.
What are we?
Bill, we probably, there's a bill drafting thing that we didn't get done yesterday.
I remember it now.
Yes.
Can we
I don't know what the rule is. Can we? Let me call. Let's see if we can just do this. It's for recording, so.